All rise, please. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Idaho is now in session pursuant to law.
Thank you very much. Please be seated. Good morning and welcome to the Idaho Supreme Court for our first and only hearing in Twin Falls today, November 5th, 2025. This case is entitled Crystal Homestead Estates, LLC versus That Piece of Property, case number 52561. The appellants are That Piece of Property, Matt Schiffman, Laura Schiffman, Michael Schiffman, and Leslie Schiffman, represented by Kent A. Higgins. And the respondent, Crystal Homestead Estates, LLC, is represented by Donald A. Sonfeld. We'd also like to make special recognition of our visitors here in Twin Falls today. First, we have the Murtaugh High School with their teachers, Nixon Montgomery and Hope Ortega. Thank you for making me be here today from Murtaugh. We have six students from Cary High School with Mr. Ryan Smith, their teachers. Welcome from Cary. And finally, the Magic Valley Commonwealth School, 14 students with their teachers, Sarah Hastings, Amanda Bingham, Crystal Saunders, and Lindsay Clark. Thank you for that. We're grateful to have you with us. We also have three representatives of Idaho's legislative branch visiting. Senator Ron Taylor is with us, Representative Pokonka, and Representative David Levitt, who are joining, and we're glad that they are part of this process to be here. We would note we would take a little time after the argument to visit with the students. We can't talk to you about this particular case, but we are happy to answer a few questions. We have maybe 15 minutes after this argument before we have to go to our next meeting, so we'll make that accommodation for the students who've made the effort to be here. With that, counsel, do any of you have any preliminary matters for us before your arguments today?
No, Your Honor.
Thank you both. Then, Mr. Higgins, I would ask that you begin, and I'm not sure the microphone's amplifying much, so you're a lot closer than you would be in Boise, but please speak up.
Thank you.
It's working well.
Chief Justice Bevin, Justice of the Idaho Supreme Court, may it please the court, my name is Kent Higgins. I am the attorney for the appellants, the Schiffmans, and That Piece of Property. My oral argument will focus primarily on two premises, the lack of fundamental fairness and failure of the plaintiff to establish even a rudimentary basis for an implied easement of historic use. The district court's opinion...
Counsel, before you begin, might I ask you, given all the students that we have here today, could you just make a general statement, brief, about what this case is about, understand why we're in court here today?
Yes. So this case, there was a piece of property that was owned years ago by the state of Idaho, ultimately handed, was temporarily in the hands of Paul Nash. He defaulted. It went back into the state of Idaho. The state of Idaho then deeded parcels of that property. One deed was to Eldred Hall in 1948, and then he deeded another property to David Johnson, who apparently was the father of Roger Johnson, who then deeded his parcel to my clients, the Schiffmans. And for years, the parcel that had gone to the Halls was owned by some parents, a parent's family, farmed by a farmer by the name of Christensen. And ultimately, the property, after been, they tried CRP, they had tried farming, they had tried cattle, and ultimately the property wound up in a Crystal Homestead Estates, LLC, a Utah corporation, which my presumption with a name like that is because it's near Lava Hot Springs and would make a nice place for summer homes. Of course, the access to that for those who would want a summer home in that area is more convenient if it crosses my client's property. So they Ultimately, the lawsuit was brought on the basis that, two of the old dirt trails across that property are really accessed by historic use or prescriptive easement or anyway, there was a number used, but the court decided only on the basis of historic use that these two roads provide legal access for Crystal Homestead Estates. So my clients basically would have to clear out and, let them have these roads across their property, which of course is pretty bad because one road runs right through the through Mike Schiffman's front yard, and the other road would disrupt Matt Schiffman's ability to subdivide his property. Our argument is that there was no historic use. It can't be established. Historic use has to be established by showing that back when the state of Idaho, or perhaps before that when Nash's owned the property, but the last time it was in unity of title in the state of Idaho, was to show that the state of Idaho used those two roads to cross my client's property to get to the other parcel that had been deeded to Eldred Hall. We assert that there was no evidence of that, there's no evidence of that. It's just the typical dirt trails that you'll find in what this court referred to before as land of sagebrush and jackrabbits, and that they had not been used by the state of Idaho to cross from one to another. Therefore, there was no historic use. The primary evidence that's had is the testimony of a 95-year-old gentleman who in 1983 deeded these parcels to the Schiffmans and swore in his, affirmed in his deeds that there was no easements whatsoever across his property, but later at 95, signs a declaration that says, well, everybody knew that those roads were so that the owners of Crystal Homestead Estates could access their property. And so that's our first issue of fact, basically, is, well, what was true, those deeds or his later declaration when he's age 95?
Thank you. That was very helpful.
Thank you. The court began its opinion by saying, okay, we are going to look at the objections to the affidavits of Randy Hobson, Matt Schiffman, Mike Schiffman, and Elaine Colby. The court rejected all of those affidavits in their entirety, and then the court went on to reject Matt Schiffman and Mike Schiffman's later affidavits without ever mentioning them, and rejecting the affidavit of Ms. Polby, who is a county officer who kept the records, who provided a document showing that the county, that there is an alternative access road, the Mullen Canyon Road, which has been recognized in the past by the county, again, alleviating much of the issue of necessity. It's necessary to have an alternate route. Then the court, after it struck all those affidavits and just simply didn't address the affidavit of Carrie Polby, didn't expressly reject the second affidavits of Mike and Matt Schiffman, but impliedly did because never addressed them again. Then the court went on to look at defendants' motions to strike affidavits. Never did the court even address the declarations of Roger Johnson or the other letter of Roger Johnson that was attached to the affidavits of Donald Sonnefeld. Well, those are the key elements. The key evidence in the case are those is that declaration by Roger Johnson, because without that, there's not even a hint that those roads have any sort of historic use. We had objected to both of those statements on the basis that they were not based on personal knowledge, not within the competency of the declarant, not admissible in evidence, they were conclusory, hearsay, no foundation.
Well, you also attacked them, as you did here earlier today, based on the fact that the declarant was 95 years old. Was there any evidence admitted in the record, or that should have been admitted in the record, that would establish he wasn't competent merely because he was 95 years old?
Absolutely. And that was his daughter stepped forward voluntarily, not by our contact, and said, my father is senile. He's suffering from dementia. He would have signed whatever was put under his nose. The attorneys brought this to him. I read it to him. And he said, that sounds about right, and signed it.
That's not quite what she said in her affidavit, though. She mentioned nothing about his competency at the time he signed the affidavit, did she? She just talked about his current condition.
I would have to double check that, but as I recall, it seemed like she was referring to it at the time that she presented it to him, that he would have signed anything that was put in front of him. He's cooperative, and I guess I'd have to double check on that. But my impression, because in our brief I indicated that unlike the Nelson versus Nelson case, where they were talking about a much prior history, I know that at least in my brief I indicated that she was talking about that at the time when he was signing those affidavits. And that's one of the reasons that Nelson is distinguishable, besides the fact that in Nelson, the attorney went to great lengths to prove that the person was competent. They had medical evidence that he was competent, that would confirm that he was competent when he did the will. Whereas in this case, that was the only thing. The only testimony we had was the daughter. In Farm Bureau Life Insurance versus Bradley, 598 FedSup, the judge there indicated that family and friends are probably the best witnesses you can have when somebody's 95 years old, whether they're suffering from dementia. You're not going to take them in every time to a doctor. And if you did, what's the doctor going to rely on? He's going to rely on those family and friends to determine, ask questions about what his competency is like. And in fact, if they had taken Roger Johnson at age 95 to a doctor, probably the first person he would have asked was his primary caretaker, which was his daughter, Elena Cobley.
My struggle with Ms. Cobley's affidavit, she does say in the last paragraph, Roger is not mentally competent to testify from memory as to any legal matter, and he hasn't been for at least 2 years. Okay, covers the time frame when Roger signed his affidavit declaration. I don't see any explanation for why she believes that. In other words, when I read her affidavit, it appears conclusory, and she doesn't give any foundation for why she believes he's not competent. She says he has not been diagnosed with Alzheimer's, but he does suffer from long-term and short-term dementia. I don't know why she thinks that. There's nothing in here that, other than a conclusory assertion. That's where's the foundation for her to make these conclusions?
Well, and I appreciate that, and I appreciate that we're going to look at our conclusory and unfounded statements. Because we go to the declaration of Roger Johnson.
And I understand, and I'd like to focus on Cobley. I understand we should be treated equivalently, and the district court allowed Roger Johnson's conclusory assertions and struck Cobley's conclusory assertions. I just want to focus on where is the foundation for her statements?
In her statements, she talks about the incident when they brought the document in front of her. That's probably about as good as you're going to get. When she contacted us, we prepared an affidavit for her. She said, here's what I can testify to. She sent it back. We took it verbatim, put it into a declaration, or into an affidavit, and she signed it as was. Could we have done it more artfully? Yes. Was I going to argue with her? No.
And I understand that. I'm just struggling because she says he has dementia. He hasn't been competent for 2 years. I don't understand what the basis for those statements is because she doesn't lay it out. She does talk about received an affidavit in the mail. I read it to him. He said that's about right. When he said that's about right, I should have realized he was agreeing to something that he had no accurate memory of. And her only explanation for why she should have realized that is a general statement that when he's asked questions, he's easily led and will say that's about right when he has no idea what he's agreeing to. I don't know what those conversations were. I don't know what he agreed to, why she thought he didn't understand what was happening, when this was happening. Was it during the 2 years that she says he's not competent? That's where I'm just not seeing the foundation for her conclusions. He wasn't competent when he signed this thing.
2 points to that effect. First of all, she indicated in the very first, second paragraph that she was his primary caregiver. She's the one that's looking after him all the time. She's the one that's watching over him. The second point, the plaintiffs have been preparing this case for over a year, including their pre-approach to summary judgment. Once they get it filed, once they file the motion, we have 28 days to respond. And we were rapidly investigating everything we could, talking to the various state departments to establish Mullen Canyon Road as a county road.
I understand that, but the rules of civil procedure also give you an avenue under Rule 56 to say, Judge, I need more time to respond to it and to lay out, here's the evidence I need to gather. Here's how I'm going to gather it. Here's how I expect to use it to oppose the motion they filed. And so part of my struggle as well is you did have a mechanism under the rules to go to the court and say, time out. Don't fast track this. Give me some time to explore. And you could have said this gentleman's competency because I have reasons to question based on the discussions with Ms. Cobley, whether he's really competent or not.
That's very true. However, this was not a trial. This was for summary judgment. We already had that he had directly contradicted his deeds with this declaration. We've already got an issue of fact that gets us past that. We already had the Mullen Canyon Road issue. We already had the issues about the timing. The timing didn't come up until the judge's opinion if they got the property, even in 1946, he had never seen those roads before that. You've got to prove a continuous use by the state of Idaho for years before that happens that they intended. We felt like we were sufficiently armed for a summary judgment motion. We did ask for the one extension so we could get the county records. But again, she was going to say what she was going to say. And no, we didn't spend the extra money to take the time to go take his deposition to prove that he was incompetent. We felt that even with his competency, the contradictions that he made were more than sufficient to get us to pass a summary judgment. And then we could go ahead and take those depositions and prepare the matter for trial.
Well, it also strikes me you could have even asked her some more questions about why. Tell me more about this. You say he'll say that sounds about right, and he has no idea. I mean, just it strikes me that putting some more detail in here, right? I'm not saying you had to contradict what she said, this is what I can say, but even probing it some more, you may have gotten the foundation. But as it stands, what was filed doesn't really explain why she thinks he's not competent to sign this affidavit. And so that's where I'm struggling with how did the district court err if that explanation isn't in here?
And I would also add, it doesn't explain why, if she was his caretaker, she allowed him to sign a document if she didn't think he was competent to do so.
No, it didn't. It really didn't. But I felt like I had about as much cooperation as I was going to get from her. Her testimony was key. I did not want to push her and say, this won't work. We've got to have more. You've got to say this. We've got to have those declarations. So I took what she offered us.
But even if I would have read Cobley's affidavit to be sufficient in terms of foundation based on what you're saying. I mean, what does this court do when the standard of review is abuse of discretion? I mean, how do we say that the district court abused its discretion?
Her testimony wasn't, if I recall, it wasn't, the court did not enumerate any of the objections that this court has had. The court simply said, it's discretionary with me. And so I reject it because it's discretionary. And I don't have to accept this outside testimony on competency. She's not a doctor.
So which of the Lundberg factors then would apply here?
Which?
The abuse of discretion factor sent forth under Lundberg, which of those would apply here? How did the court abuse its discretion?
First of all, the court applied a different standard. He let all of Roger Johnson's testimony in, which are all conclusory, which if he has any knowledge of how that road was used, I mean, he says in there, well, everyone knew that that was CHE's access to the property. Well, who's everyone?
Just to be clear, you can't point to a legal error. You're just saying it's not fair?
I think it's kind of a matter of first impression to say to apply a double standard.
But that's, isn't the argument really he either violated the abuse of discretion standard by striking hers, or he violated the abuse of discretion standard by considering his? I mean, it strikes me you have to say he didn't apply the law fairly on one or the other and then point out how he didn't apply the law, rather than saying you should have treated us the same. Because that, to me, that's what your argument amounts to, is you should have treated us the same. And I'm looking at this saying, under abuse of discretion, if he had two different outcomes, one was right and one was wrong, so you attack the one that was wrong.
Well, now, I think, again, he's weighing the credibility of the witnesses, which is not appropriate at summary judgment stage.
How did the judge weigh the credibility of the witnesses? The judge noted, I think at least once or twice in the record, that he said that there are some quite a credibility questions, but the judge didn't answer those questions. Did the judge make a definitive ruling that one witness was more credible than another?
He struck the affidavits of the Schiffmans entirely, even the foundational affidavits of the certified copies of the deeds, which Roger Johnson and his wife had signed saying, there's no easements across this property. And then he struck the second affidavits without even addressing them, simply because he said, he basically says, they're inconsistent, so I reject the totality.
So the judge said that there was conflict internally within the affidavits. And then the judge went on to opine, perhaps unnecessarily, this raises credibility questions. But the question about whether or not the contradictions render them inadmissible, that was the basis of the ruling, wasn't it?
The contradictions?
Yeah.
Yes.
You have an affidavit where an affiant swears under oath that the light was red, and then the next paragraph swears that it was green. Is that a credibility issue, or is that an issue of the person talking out of both sides of their mouth?
Well,
there's no reason to give it, not only not give it weight, but legally it's a wash.
Well, and my brief outlines a number of examples where, you know, for example, the court says, well, how do the Schiffmans know how the roads were used before they were there? Well, how do they know if the ground was farmed before they were there? I've got a four-year-old grandchild that can tell you whether the ground's been farmed or not.
But they didn't say that. I think the point is that the Schiffman declarations said things, but they didn't say how they knew things. And I think my reading of the judge's decision was that was the concern. And I want to go back, if I could, please, to Elaine Cobley's affidavit. You mentioned that the judge just rejected her declaration. I don't have to consider that. What he said after he talked about another case involving competency was this: a review of the affidavit of Elaine Cobley shows a similar lack of foundation for her conclusions. Ms. Cobley states that her father is not mentally competent and that he cannot recall details from long-term memories or experience to any degree of accuracy. She further claims Roger has not been diagnosed with Alzheimer's, but he does suffer from long-term and short-term dementia. However, the judge goes on, Ms. Cobley does not provide any basis for such claims of incompetence
as she offers no foundation on which a diagnosis of dementia may be introduced, such as a date of diagnosis or information about the progression of the condition. And he goes on from there in the same vein. My question to you, Mr. Higgins, is where is there an abuse of discretion in that aspect of the judge's ruling with respect to Ms. Cobley's declaration?
But again, I think that the bottom line is we were preparing this to defend it on the basis that there are issues of fact and this is not a matter for summary judgment. Undoubtedly, once we got past summary judgment, we're going to go take those depositions, we're going to get the details. But we worked with what we had.
Before you run out of time, I have a question for you. I agree with you. Probably that's your best argument, that there was issues of fact that prevented summary judgment. And I've known you for a while, Mr. Higgins, so this is a hard question for me to ask you, but I'm going to ask you about a statement you made on page 25 of your brief.
Okay.
On page 25, you said the following: the safest way for a lower court to appeal proof its grant of summary judgment is to toss out all the affidavits of the losing party and accept all from the prevailing. That is what happened here. And I'm just wondering, is it ever proper to accuse a judge of reaching his decision by striking out admissible documents just to shield it from appellate review? That's what you've said here.
I didn't mean that as an accusation to the court as much as I was saying that all of ours got tossed out, all of theirs got in.
But I understand that, but the way this reads is you're suggesting the judge didn't throw them out for good legal cause. He threw them out because he was trying to make his decision appeal-proof. That's somewhat scandalous of an accusation, don't you think?
Yes, probably is.
Do you want to retract that?
I would gladly retract that. I didn't mean it to be. I tried to keep it from being as accusative as possible. You take the totality of the opinion. The court vacillated on the date of severance, or put the date of severance at 1948. Well, not even the plaintiffs put it in 1948. Not even the deeds put it in 1948. It just seemed like the reading of our depositions and the critiquing of our depositions was making it impossible for us to move forward. And I felt like we had established issues of fact. When I said that's what happened here, I was meaning that those got thrown out. All of ours got thrown out. All of ours got thrown out, including Povey's, including the second affidavits. All of theirs got in, despite our objections and the fact that our objections were never even addressed as to the documents of Roger Johnson. So I realized that you can read it the way that it was said, and for that I apologize.
Well, that's okay. But I appreciate your factual-based argument that there were issues of fact that prevented summary judgment from being issued. That's, I think, where we're going to have to decide this case, isn't it?
Yes. Thank you. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time.
Thank you. Mr. Sonfeld, when you're ready.
Chief Justice Bevin and members of the court, my name is Donald Sonfeld, and I represent Crystal Homestead Estates in this matter. May it please the court. The Shipman's opening brief was little more than a complaint about the district court's analysis. It fails to point to any prong of the abuse of discretion standard, much less argue that any prong was not met.
Well, hold on. So when we get to the Shiffman declarations, affidavits, can't remember which they were, I apologize. Mr. Higgins does point out that the district court did not have authority to strike the first seven paragraphs of the affidavits. They didn't suffer from lack of personal knowledge. They didn't suffer from the issues you raised in your motion to strike them. So help me understand how that is not an argument that invokes the abuse of discretion standard, and help me understand how the district court had authority to strike those paragraphs.
Well, number one, Justice Son, the court set forth the standards in the decision. It's page 440 of the record, the standard for affidavit submitted on summary judgment. And he applied that standard. Ultimately, he had a six-page analysis of those affidavits, and he came to the conclusion that there were multiple fatal errors throughout them. And so initially he says those are stricken, but then because of the flaws throughout, he struck the entirety of them. So he didn't abuse his discretion because he acted within the bounds of authority.
I'm not aware of case law that says if a lot of the affidavit is problematic, you get to strike the non-problematic parts of it. For example, there's a paragraph, I purchased the property from Roger and Kay Johnson, who gave myself and my wife Leslie a warranty deed. What is objectionable about that? What's the basis to strike it, or what's the legal authority that says if later paragraphs lack foundation and have issues, you can strike this one?
Your Honor, I don't have it in front of me. And what I'll tell you is that the court made two separate findings in its decision to strike. First, the inadmissible stuff was stricken, and then it came back and struck the rest of it. But those facts in the first seven points weren't issues of fact. Those were issues that CHE had in his complaint.
Well,
so he didn't create a genuine issue of fact because they were the same things that we had alleged.
Just because they weren't disputed doesn't mean that they're not facts that they can put into the record. It would seem to me that the abuse of discretion here is the court throwing the baby out with the bathwater and perhaps using the inconsistencies later in the document to make a credibility determination about the first part of the document. That's what the appellant's arguing here. I believe that's how he's saying that the affidavits were improperly weighed, because the court somehow got an opinion about the inconsistencies and applied that to undisputed but certainly legitimate issues of fact.
Well, two things. Number one is the district court referred to a question of credibility once. He didn't make a decision on credibility. Second of all, the initial point was that the Shipmans have failed in their briefing in the appellate standard. They didn't point to the abuse of discretion standard. They didn't point to any of the prongs of the test for abuse of discretion in their opening brief.
And so
they waived that.
So when they argue in their opening brief that there was no legal basis for the court to strike paragraphs 1-7 of each of the Shiffman brothers' first declarations, how is that not invoking the abuse of discretion standard?
Well, my response would be that he didn't say that in the opening brief. He simply complained that, hey, they made these seven statements, and the court struck it. He didn't say how that violated the abuse of discretion standard in the opening brief.
So when he says there was no authority for the district court to strike it, that doesn't implicate the prong of the abuse of discretion standard that requires the court to act consistently with the legal authorities governing the options before it?
I would say no, because the court did express authority at the very beginning of his brief. It stated the standards by which it was weighing the evidence. Again, set out on the record, page 440, where it's very clear. Here's the standard for affidavits under summary judgment. And he acted within that standard to decide whether he could strike those affidavits or not.
But to Justice Zahn's point, those first seven paragraphs, there's no... The district court doesn't identify, for example, a hearsay violation. The court doesn't identify, for example, an issue concerning foundation. Those are the bases upon which you can strike a statement. And so if there's no legal basis upon which to strike those first seven paragraphs, then how does that comply with the abuse of discretion standard, which requires a judge to act in accordance with the legal standards that are applicable to the decision that is before it?
Well, in our briefing, certainly we say that it's possible that those seven statements were admissible. And if they were admissible, then perhaps there was an abuse of discretion related to those seven statements. But those seven statements don't raise a genuine issue of material fact.
So you're saying it's harmless error?
I'm saying it's harmless error at best, but it's not something for which this court should overturn the decision.
I guess where I get in my own challenges with his lack of any real analysis of Roger Johnson. He just says it's strict, or the motion to strike is overruled, considers it all, doesn't address, strikes the lanes. But he just doesn't have, he goes on, as you say, six or seven pages about the defendant's affidavit. As to Roger, he says it in a few words. Is that, I mean, I get they didn't raise the standard directly in their opening brief, but they certainly say the court erred by striking her affidavit and not striking his. And I guess I'm just troubled by a judge, just from the optics of it, spends all this time on why the defendant's affidavits are bad, and then in a matter of a few words, it says, his is just fine.
Well, they never moved to strike Roger Johnson's affidavit. Instead, they tried to introduce Elaine Cobley's affidavit to show that he wasn't competent. And of course, under Rule 601, that's the court's decision. The judge makes that decision, not the caregiver, not the family. And so Rule 601 is a very broad standard. The case law makes it very clear that you just have to be able to answer the question, and the things that Ms. Coveley said in her declaration indicated that he heard the question, he was able to act on that question, and he did act on that question. And so her affidavit actually affirmed the court's decision that Roger Johnson was competent to testify.
Fair answer. In terms of this notion, though, that his declaration or affidavit, I'm like Justice on, I think it was an affidavit, but in any event, that just on its face, it contradicts the deeds. What about that notion?
Well, and again, the case law makes clear that the deeds are irrelevant, right? When we go back to Davis, we look at CAPSTAR 3 and 4, both say that it attached at the time of severance and are not eviscerated after a transfer in the deed. And so CAPSTAR in particular, there were multiple changes of ownership to the land before the case was brought. And yet the easement was affirmed because it attached and was permanent, according to Davis, at the time of severance, not 40 years later when the county is trying to decide, well, is this a road or not?
In fairness, though, in CAPSTAR, remember when Funk divided his property and it went to Human Synergistics, there were several deeds because there were all those different parcels. And those deeds called out that there were access, that there was an access road, you know, that it was subject to an easement. I don't think it used the term easement, but, you know, these access roads. So there is that difference. And granted, that goes back in time to the severance. But I guess along that line, I'm wondering too, is a warranty deed the same as making an affirmative representation? Can you compare them regardless of when that happens?
Justice, I would say no. The pro forma language on a warranty deed is not an affirmative representation, even though it's signed and notarized, because it is, again, just that. It's a pro forma thing. It brings with it certain obligations, but it is not my statement that says there is absolutely no other things affecting this. The title insurance has a more expositive basis for saying, hey, these are the things for which that that land is subject to.
I don't know if there's a lawsuit by the against the title company or against the grantor. They're sure going to look at that as if it was an affirmative declaration of the status of the property.
Well, and certainly that would be something that could be decided, but I have not been able to find any case law that says that a warranty deed, it somehow negates an easement that attaches as severance.
Isn't
the current case law doesn't.
Mr. Higgins' argument a little more nuanced than we're giving it credit for? I think he's suggesting that the inconsistency between the deed and then the broad statements made in Johnson's affidavit show inconsistencies like the inconsistencies he pointed out in the other deeds, and therefore it shouldn't be used to reach a conclusion that there's no dispute of fact here.
Certainly that is his argument, but I don't believe that that argument has any merit because there's at the time of severance is when we have to consider did that easement attach or not. And again, as pointed out in Davis and Capstar and that line, the warranty deed doesn't impact the validity of the easement that attached to severance. And so whether or not it impeaches his testimony, I don't think it actually does, because the statement that he gave initially, the one recorded and attached to validate his declaration, was without assistance of counsel. It was on his own. And he's, hey, this is the history of this land since my family has had it.
And I understand when that statement is weighed and considered at trial, the court may very well be within its rights to reach a fair conclusion that that statement doesn't prove anything. But for summary judgment purposes, does it create enough doubt when looked at in a light most favorable to the appellant that the court should have allowed the case to go to trial rather than granting summary judgment?
I don't believe so. Because again, the question is, did the easement attach at the time of severance? Not, was there an easement in place at the time that he signed the warranty deed, or did he know that there was an easement in place at the time that he signed the warranty deed? He might not have understood that using those roads for access, and again, completely speculative, but he might not have understood that using those roads for access meant that there was an easement there. So he may not have had an understanding of the statement that you know, Shipman's are trying to hold them accountable for.
Isn't the significance of the deed really, does Roger Johnson know what he's talking about? And what I mean by that is your client has to establish three elements to establish the easement in this case, easement by prior use. The second element is that there was a use of these roads prior to severance that was significant enough that it was expected that these roads would continue to provide that sort of access. And isn't the significance of the deed that Roger Johnson says in his affidavit, we moved there in 1946, my family bought it shortly thereafter, I know there were these roads in use, but we have a deed that says, no, you didn't, your family got it in 1952. And so isn't the significance of the deed really, does he know what he's talking about? And therefore, can you satisfy the second element that he knows what the use was prior to severance? Can you establish that through his testimony or not? And I'm struggling with how the conflicting dates doesn't create a genuine issue of material fact about what does he know? When is he aware of use? When did his family buy this property? So we can't rely on his testimony. We need to go to trial.
Well, Roger Johnson satisfies that question in his declaration. His family acquired an interest in 1946, but they realized subsequently that it wasn't properly recorded. And so they obtained the deed from the state and recorded it in 1952.
And so let me ask you, because I don't see any foundation for that statement. So he says, we moved there in 1946, I was 17. My family bought the property shortly thereafter. I assume as a minor, he was not involved in the purchase of the property. 6 years later, he now would have been 23. He says, my family realized the deed had not been properly recorded. How does he know that? I mean, presumably he wasn't involved in the purchase. And what does not properly recorded mean? I mean, I struggle with the lack of foundation in his affidavit as well. I mean, he makes a lot of conclusory statements, but I don't know what he's basing them on.
Well, I think that we can conclude easily that he's basing them on his family history and the community history of the property. He was certainly, as a teenager, he was old enough to understand what was going on within his family at that point. It's not like he was 4 years old and, no, we moved to a new house. He understood that his family had acquired land, that they had moved to this new place. No, he doesn't explain how he knew that it wasn't recorded, but...
Do you think this is covered by the hearsay exception in 803.20 concerning reputation, concerning boundaries and history?
Absolutely. It's consistent with the court's findings in Cook that held that a person who was much younger than Roger Johnson could testify regarding her family history into regarding Land Cook v. Van Orden.
But don't you have to say more than just my family? I mean, don't you have to say, I remember, you know, my dad being upset at, I'm just making stuff up at this point, but to Justice Zahn's point, there's got to be some kind of information about what leads him to this conclusion. I remember the conversation between my mom and dad. I remember going to the county assessor's office with them. That kind of information, I mean, it just comes out of nowhere.
Well, and to add on to Justice Brody's point, I sat on Cook v. Van Orden, and I remember that declaration, and it was much more detailed. It talked about what my dad did and conversations I witnessed my dad have with the neighbors, and they talked about this, and my mom told me that, and there was foundation for why the affiant or the declarant believed this conclusory assertion or this conclusion.
And to that point, I mean, back in the day in common law England, I mean, they used to run kids around and pinch them and hit them and things like that so that they would remember 40 years down the road, oh yeah, I remember when that land changed hands because, you know, I got punched in the arm. And I mean, that's the way they did things, so that people recalled these significant events.
Well, and Roger Johnson testified to the significance of having moved into the area. Right? That's how his life changed when they moved into the area in 1946.
But that's it. We moved there. There's nothing about, I talked to my mom and dad about when they bought the property. There's nothing about mom and dad told me they learned, you know, they went down to get a copy of the deed and they asked for it and they said, we don't have it. I mean, there's none of that. There is just a conclusory assertion. And, you know, I mean, my struggle with the hearsay exception that you're citing is the language of it is a reputation in the community arising before the controversy concerning boundaries of land. We're not talking about boundaries of land. Or customs that affect land. Maybe we're in that realm. But what is the reputation in the community? The general historical events are important to that community, state, or nation. And so I'm struggling with how this fits in there.
Well, number one,
and I will apologize, Mr. Sonnefeld, I was citing the wrong, you were probably going to tell me you were citing the wrong exception. So a reputation among a person's family or among a person's associates in the community concerning the person's birth, adoption, legitimacy, ancestry, marriage, divorce, death, relationship by blood, adoption, or marriage, or similar facts of personal or family history. There's nothing in that list that says property or recording of deeds or roads. I mean, it's all personal family information. And so I almost feel like you're melding 19 and 20 together, but they're separate.
Well, and we did argue that both of them may apply, and recognizing that 20 was the issue at issue in Cook, that was supported, but the community reputation was that everybody knew. It was common knowledge that those roads were the access point to get to the dominant estate. And there was no question of fact. There was additional support for it from other non-parties. Christensen affidavit, for example, when he talked about a prior owner, prior to the parent families that were using that road to farm the northern parcel because he was a part of their farming. They hired him to work on their lands, and that was how they got across it. But I think the second and also important thing to consider is the Shipmans didn't attack Roger Johnson's affidavit based on lack of foundation, based on personal knowledge. They attacked it based on his competence. And so the question before the court was not, did it lack foundation? Did it lack personal knowledge? Did it meet the requirements of a hearsay exception? Rather, it was he competent or was he not competent? And so the question that you're asking me was never presented to the district court.
And so I guess my struggle, though, is as I read that declaration, even Mr. Johnson's statement, it was widely known that there's no foundation for that. And my struggle is inherent in your argument is, and correct me if I'm wrong, the assertion that a district court should not independently review the evidence to determine whether it's admissible. It should just assume it's all admissible unless a party objects. And I'm not sure that I agree that's the rule. And so when I look at this declaration and I see that there's no foundation for these statements, I'm concerned about how the district court could rely on them, because Rule 56 requires the declarations to submit evidence that would be admissible in court. And I'm struggling with the admissibility of this evidence. So are you asserting the district court can't consider that independently unless somebody objects?
I'm certainly not asserting that the district court doesn't have an obligation to independently review the evidence. But the record doesn't support that was ever called into question. Certainly the decision makes reference to the admissibility of the Johnson Declaration. When he was looking at the question of the notarized statement in my declaration, he says, you know what, I found that it was admissible and credible when we looked at the Cobley affidavit, therefore I'm not going to address it here. So he made some finding that it was admissible evidence. Now, whether that was an error or not, it's not something that's been challenged. The only thing that's been challenged in regard to the Johnson affidavit is whether or not he was competent to testify based on the Elaine Cobley affidavit.
So can we then, because we're going to be reviewing the district court's decision on summary judgment de novo, so can we consider for the first time whether there's the necessary foundation for the statements made in Roger Johnson's affidavit?
Certainly, in a de novo review, you can consider the evidence, but and whether there's a question of fact, that's certainly within the standards that this court.
But what can we consider whether there's adequate foundation for the statements in the declaration?
Well, again, I think that goes to admissibility, and you need to apply abuse of discretion, and where that hasn't been brought up on appeal, I don't believe that it would be appropriate for the court to reach down and make an evidentiary decision for the district court when it's not been challenged.
Well, let me touch on that for a second. Let's assume hypothetically that issue had been raised. The appellant had questioned in their motion to strike lack of foundation. If that had been presented at the trial court, you would have arguably had an opportunity to address the lack of foundation. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And would you have submitted evidence that we don't have in the record before us today in response to that?
Potentially, yes. There's the possibility. I mean, there certainly would have been an argument on it, and a record would have been developed. There's the possibility that there were other people involved. Certainly, my office worked with Mr. Johnson's son in developing the statement that he signed. Because at the time we were developing his affidavit, he wasn't living with Elaine Copley. She had no idea what was going on or how it got there. It was only after there was a finished draft for him to sign that, oh, look, he has moved in with his daughter. And Mr. Johnson's son said, oh, send this to my sister because that's where he lives now. So had it been challenged on other grounds, there certainly would have been more of a record developed to determine what the foundation was, how he knew these things, and whether or not these standards were met.
Before you run out of time, I'd like to change directions just a bit and go back to the years 46 and 52.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the judge determined that severance happened in 1948. So two questions. What was the basis for the judge's determination that severance was in 1948? Second question, does it make a difference? And actually, third question, if the proper date of severance is 1952, does it make a difference?
1948 is the date that the northern parcels were deeded to, and I forget the name of the people that received them. And so that's where the 1948 comes from. That's the record of when the dominant parcels were deeded away from the state. And they were done in separate deeds, which is why there's two roads, one going this side, one going to that side. Does it matter? It's a little bit of a squishy question. Because the case law says it's when the party acquired an interest. And so the Johnson family acquired their interest in 1946, but they didn't record their deed until 1952. And so I believe it's a reasonable decision for the court to say, you know what, regardless of if it's 46 or 52 when the Johnsons got their land, 48 is when the record says that the dominant parcels were severed, and so he has a definite date in the record that says 1948 is when officially on record that property separated. And so does it matter for our purposes? I don't believe it does.
Well, could an easement arise in 1948 in favor of ultimately your clients?
Yes and no. If the Johnson family actually had purchased the road or the property and they just didn't have a recorded deed, then yeah, the easement would have attached and continued despite the road. If the Johnson hadn't officially purchased it at that point, then that Serbian land is still the property of the state. Do you get an easement against the state? No, the state doesn't grant easements, but they still need the access. And so they can access over public lands, and so it's when that Serbian parcel changes hands that the easement might attach.
Just a short question. I see you're out of time. I leave with the chief. It sounds like that argument is an easement by necessity argument, not an easement by historic use argument.
Well, we presented arguments for easement by necessity as well. And of course, necessity is an element of easement by historic use.
Is there a difference as far as the court's decision and how it ultimately what it rested on?
Well, the district court found an easement implied by historic use and declined to take up the other two theories of easement that were advanced on summary judgment because they were, it was unnecessary to go there. But certainly there was reasonable necessity at that point. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Madam Clerk, how much time does the appellant have remaining?
4 minutes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you. First, I'd like in the record, Gerald E. Neisser, Trustee, Revocable Living Trust, 170 Idaho, 692. That was the last time this court declared that district court abused discretion in how it handled affidavits. And I think you'll find there that the issues of lack of foundation and other things compared to the paragraphs in Neisser are more than adequate to show that there was lack of, that the same errors were committed here. We did object repeatedly to the declaration of Roger Johnson and to Donald Sonnenfeld. That's record pages 318 through 320, 354, 366 through 7, and 368 through 20. And in there, we objected on the basis of not based on personal knowledge, not within the competency of the declarant, not admissible evidence, conclusory, hearsay, and lack of foundation. So those objections were made.
And it's not called a motion to strike. The objection wasn't given a title motion to strike, but the objection was clearly stated.
I think one of them was a motion to strike, and the rest was the objections that were raised. The pro forma warranty deed, it wasn't standard pro forma language, actually, because it didn't even address easements of record. It says there's no easements. There's nothing across that property. And I think that it's also in our briefing that then the two predecessors, the deeds, both predecessors of title said the same thing, that there's no easements in the record.
But would you address Justice Meyer's question about whether the statement in the deed can be used, or whether the sentence in the deed can be compared to Roger Johnson's statements in the affidavit?
Yes, in the Capstar case, first thing the Capstar said is if a case is complex, you don't get rid of it on summary judgment.
Well, that's not exactly what it said.
I'm sorry, I'm paraphrasing because I'm about out of time.
Okay.
But it does say that case was complex enough that it shouldn't have just been dismissed on summary judgment. And in the Capstar case, it says when their affidavit says one thing and their deposition says another thing, you got an issue of fact.
Yeah, but this is a deed.
It's a deed signed under oath. It's notarized. And my clients bought that property being told there was no easements across that property.
It was notarized. Doesn't mean it was signed under oath. The notary is just basically a testament that the person whose signature is written there is the same as the person that signed it. Right?
Okay.
It's not administered under oath.
I apologize. A lot of the notaries say under oath, but it's not under oath. However, it was a declaration by the same party that directly contradicts his later statement. And I think that raises an issue of fact, at least for summary judgment. What we decide in trial is another thing. But, you know, we had issues of fact. We had several issues of fact. We have the issue of facts of his inconsistent declarations. We have the issues of fact about Mullen Canyon Road, the issues of fact about the discrepancy in the separation, date of separation, and the reason that's important is because there had to have been proof of the use of the road by the state of Idaho before the date of separation. If you place that date as 1946, that's as soon as Roger Johnson knew anything. Beyond that, those could have just been desert roads, just sagebrush roads. But if you put the date of separation as 1948, well, then he's got 2 years of knowledge if he saw them in 1946. And the court relies on 1948 as the date of separation because that's the date that the other parcel was sold. But if the other parcel was sold first, then the easement would be across that land to my clients, not the other way around. So,
sir, I believe you're out of time.
I'm out of time. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you for coming today, counsel. To each of you, we appreciate your argument. Matter is under advisement. We'll render a decision in due course. The court is now in recess until Friday, November 7th in Boise. Thank you. And we'll be back to talk to students just momentarily.
All rise, please.